Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're jumping straight into some fascinating physics today, electric charges and fields.
That's right.
You sent over some textbook excerpts, and we're going to dig into how external electric fields mess with electric dipoles, and also this idea of continuous charge distribution.
Yeah, moving beyond just point charges.
Exactly. So the mission is to really get the fundamentals, how dipoles behave in fields, uniform or not.
And also wrap our heads around this continuous charge concept. How does that actually work in practice?
Right. And it's not just abstract stuff. We mentioned maybe touching on why, like a charged comb picks up bits of paper.
Definitely. That seemingly simple thing is actually a perfect example of these principles at work. It involves non-uniform fields, which we'll get to.
Cool. Okay, so let's start with the basics. Electric dipoles in a uniform external field. What are we picturing?
Okay, so first, you need to picture a permanent electric dipole. Think of it as having a built-in charge separation, a positive end and a negative end, same amount of charge, held slightly apart.
Like a tiny magnet, but for electric fields.
Sort of, yeah. It has an inherent dipole moment, we call it P. And permanent just means it has this moment all the time, field or no field.
Got it. Now, put this little dipole into an external electric field, E, and this field is uniform, meaning it's the same everywhere around the dipole.
Yep, same strength, same direction, everywhere the dipole feels it.
So what happens? Each end feels a force, right?
Exactly. The positive charge feels a force, QE, pulling it with the field. The negative charge feels a force, AE, pulling it against the field.
Okay, so equal forces, opposite directions. Does that mean the whole thing just sits there, no net movement?
In a uniform field, yes, the net force is zero. It won't accelerate off in one direction.
There's that.
There is, because those equal and opposite forces are acting on different points, the separated ends of the dipole.
Ah, so it's like pushing opposite sides of a wheel. It creates a twist, a torque.
Precisely. It experiences a torque. It wants to rotate.
Okay, how strong is that twisting force? How do we figure that out?
Well, the torque magnitude depends on the force strength, QE, and the perpendicular distance between the lines those forces act along. We call that the lever arm.
Right.
If the charge separation is, say, 2A, and the dipole makes an angle theta with the field E, then that perpendicular distance turns out to be 2A times sin theta.
Okay.
So the torque magnitude is force times distance, QE times 2A sin theta, which is 2KE sin theta.
Oh, wait, 2K, that's the magnitude of the dipole moment, P, isn't it? Charge times separation.
You got it. So the torque simplifies really nicely to just PE sin theta.
PE sin theta. Neat.
And even better, in vector form, the torque vector is just the cross product, T cross E.
PEE. And the cross product tells us the direction too, right?
It does, perpendicular to both P and E. And the key takeaway is this torque always tries to rotate the dipole until it aligns with the external field E.
Like a compass needle in a magnetic field, it wants to point north.
Exactly like that. And when P is aligned with E, theta is zero. Sine of zero is zero.
So the torque becomes zero. It stops twisting once it's lined up.
Perfect. That's the stable equilibrium position.
Okay, that makes sense for a uniform field. But what if the field isn't uniform? What if E changes from place to place?
Now things get more interesting. If the field strength or direction is different at the positive end compared to the negative end,
Then those forces, QE and Nash QE, won't be exactly equal and opposite anymore.
exactly, they won't necessarily cancel out. So in a non-uniform field, the dipole will generally experience a net force. It might actually start moving.
So it could both rotate and move as a whole.
Generally, yes. You'll often have both a net force and a torque. Calculating it precisely gets a bit trickier, depends on exactly how the field changes.
Okay. Are there simpler cases we can look at?
Yeah, let's consider alignment. Imagine the dipole moment P is already pointing in the same direction as E, but E is getting stronger in that direction.
Okay. P parallel to E, field increasing along E.
Right. The positive charge is now in a slightly stronger field than the negative charge.
So the force pulling the positive charge forward is a bit bigger than the force pulling the negative charge backward.
Precisely. The result is a net force pushing the whole dipole towards the region of stronger field.
It gets pulled towards the stronger field. Makes sense. What if it's anti-aligned? If P points opposite to the direction E is increasing?
Good question. Now the negative charge is in the stronger field region.
So the backward pull on the negative charge is stronger than the forward push on the positive charge.
Yep. So the net force is now in the opposite direction, pushing the dipole towards the region where the field is weaker.
Okay, so aligned dipoles get pulled to stronger fields, anti-aligned ones get pushed to weaker fields.
That's the gist of it for those simple cases. In general, the force depends on the specific orientation and how the field changes.
This sounds very relevant to that comb and paper example you mentioned earlier.
It absolutely is. Let's connect those dots. You run a comb through your hair, it gets charged. It now creates its own electric field around it.
Okay. And you brush near a neutral piece of paper.
Right. The paper itself is neutral overall, but it's made of molecules. The comb's electric field affects the charges within those molecules.
It pushes the electrons one way and the positive nuclei the other way, slightly.
Exactly. It causes a tiny separation of charge within each molecule, or it might reorient existing polar molecules. The end result is that the paper develops a net-induced dipole moment. It becomes polarized.
So the paper, even though still neutral, acts like it's full of tiny dipoles, all lined up with the comb's field.
That's the picture. The dipoles are induced by the comb's field and point along it.
But why the attraction? If it's still neutral, why does it move towards the comb?
Here's the crucial piece. The electric field from the comb is not uniform.
It's strongest right near the comb and gets weaker further away.
Precisely. And what did we just say about dipoles aligned with a non-uniform field?
They feel a net force towards the stronger field region.
And where is the field strongest?
Right next to the comb.
So the induced dipoles in the neutral paper feel a net force pulling them towards the comb. That's the attraction you see.
Wow. Okay, that clicks. It's the polarization plus the non-uniformity of the field. That's really neat.
Isn't it? It ties everything together beautifully.
Okay, so that covers dipoles pretty well. Now let's shift gears to this idea of continuous charge distribution. Why do we need that? Point charges seem simpler.
They are simpler conceptually, but imagine trying to calculate the field from, say, a charged metal sphere by adding up the field from every single electron on its surface. It's practically impossible.
There are trillions upon trillions of them.
Exactly. So for macroscopic objects, we need a more practical approach. We average things out. Instead of individual charges, we talk about how much charge is packed into a certain region.
Like density, but for charge.
Precisely. Yeah. We define charge densities. If charge is spread over a surface, like that metal sphere, we use surface charge density. It's usually written as sigma, the Greek letter.
Okay. Sigma, what is it?
It's the amount of charge, Q, found on a small patch of surface area, aocs, divided by that area. So secu possess is Q.
Charge per area. Makes sense. Units would be coulombs per square meter.
Coulombs per square meter, yes. And it's important to remember this is a macroscopic average. Zoom way in and you'd still see individual electrons, but from further back, it looks smooth.
Okay. What if the charge is spread along a line, like a long charged wire?
Then we use linear charge density, usually lambda.
Lambda.
It's the charge Q on a small length segment divided by that length. Coulomb Cule.
Charge per length. Coulombs per meter.
Coulombs per meter. Same idea. It's an average over a small length that still contains many, many charges.
And the third type, if charge fills a volume.
Then it's volume charge density, usually rho.
Rho.
That's the charge Q inside a small volume element divided by that volume. Charge per volume?
Coulombs per cubic meter.
Coulombs per cubic meter, exactly. So we have tools for 1D, 2D, and 3D distributions.
It's just like mass density mechanics, really.
Yeah.
You talk about density of a fluid or a solid block.
It's a very similar concept, yes. It allows us to treat charge mathematically as if it were a continuous fluid or substance spread through space or on a surface.
Okay, so we have these densities. How do we actually calculate the electric field from, say, a charged plate with surface density sigma? We can't just plug sigma into Coulomb's law.
No, but we can use the same fundamental tools, Coulomb's law and superposition.
Superposition, adding things up.
Right. We mentally chop up the continuous distribution into tiny, tiny pieces. Each tiny piece contains a small amount of charge, Q.
Okay.
Let's take the volume case with density. Imagine a tiny volume element, A, at some position R. The charge in it is coulombs rho.
Right.
Now, we can treat this tiny Q as if it were a point charge for a moment.
Ah, okay. So we can use Coulomb's law for just that tiny piece.
Exactly. We calculate the tiny electric field that this specific piece produces at the point P, or we want to know the total field.
So we find the distance from coloria P, call it R, find the unit vector R pointing that way.
And use Coulomb's law. That gives the field contribution from just that one tiny piece.
Okay, so we have the field from one infinitesimal chunk. Now what?
Now we do that for every tiny chunk that makes up the entire charged object.
And add them all up. All those tiny U vectors.
Add them all up vectorially. That's superposition. The total electric field E is the sum of all the IE contributions from all the UV elements.
So A over the whole volume.
Pretty much. Now, mathematically, to be perfectly accurate, we let those volume elements become infinitesimally small. AV approaches DV, and the sum becomes an integral.
Right. Calculus kicks in for the continuous case.
But the physics principle is the same. Break it down into point charge-like pieces, use Coulomb's law for each, and add up the results using superposition.
And this works for surface and linear densities too, just using AS or air instead of BV.
Absolutely. The process is analogous. It's a PowerSol technique that lets us handle the fields from basically any charge distribution, discrete points, continuous SMEOs, or a mix of both.
Okay, let's quickly recap then. We looked at dipoles, how they experience torque in uniform fields, trying to align.
And both torque and a net force in non-uniform fields, which explained the comb and paper trick.
Right. That attraction comes from induced dipoles feeling a force towards the stronger, non-uniform field near the comb.
Then we move to continuous charge, using linear surface and volume densities, sub, to describe charge spread out over objects.
And we saw how to find the electric field from these continuous distributions by breaking them into tiny pieces, applying Coulomb's law, and summing it all up with superposition, which often means integration in practice.
You've summarized it perfectly. We've built up from basic forces to understanding macroscopic effects and calculation methods.
Yeah, that comb example really was an aha moment, seeing how non-uniformity is key.
It often is. Simple observations sometimes hide quite subtle physics.
Absolutely. So for a final thought to leave everyone with, how critical is this idea of continuous charge distribution? Where else does it pop up?
Oh, everywhere. Think about designing capacitors, understanding how charge arranges itself on conductors, analyzing antennas.
Or even natural phenomena like atmospheric electricity, maybe how charge builds up in clouds leading to lightning.
Exactly. That's a huge system involving charge distributed over vast volumes and surfaces. Understanding the resulting fields requires thinking continuously. So maybe consider, where else in technology or nature is the distribution of charge, not just its presence, the crucial factor?
Good question to ponder. All right, that's our deep dive for today. Until next time, keep thinking.